Space Gumps, Space Gumps, this is Space Gumps, this is Space Gumps, this is Space Gumps, copyright strike, avoiding Space Gumps, Space Gumps, Space Gumps, Space Gumps.
Oh, hello you. Welcome to Space Scamps, a show within a show where two casual Star Trek fans get so casual that we actually look at an entirely different science fiction TV show. Yes, we're back to Space 1999, brought to you by Nerd and Ty and the concept of getting possessed by weird cosmic entities. Put your feet up and chill out. We're in the driving seat now. Just ignore the screaming and the goo. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn. I'm a writer and a fan of the John Wick movie series.
And I'm Mars Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of the film The Abominable Dr. Phibes, where Vincent Price plays a crazed, deformed doctor who is hunting down and killing the medical professionals who failed to save his wife 6 years ago and killing them using the 10 plagues of Egypt as a theme. Why did I choose this film? Well, I did watch the film recently, but also, given that we've had both Christopher Lee and, in this episode, Peter Cushing appearing on Space Scamps, I felt it would be worthwhile to complete the triumvirate, as it were.
Yeah, bring in old Vincent. I'm guessing that means we do not get a Vincent Price appearance in Space 1999.
No, although Vincent Price as a member of the Q would have been amazing.
Oh God, yes. So, yeah, with that in mind, we will press on. But first, Mars, what non-Star Trek, non-Space 1999 things have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
So, Charlie.
Yes.
It's come up once or twice that I am a fan of Doctor Who.
Just a little bit of one.
Just a little bit. And so, you know how there's like nearly about 90 or so episodes of Doctor Who which are missing due to the fact that the BBC would just take whole, like, film reels and just tape over them because of space?
I was ranting to someone just today about that very thing.
Well, we found two brand new classic episodes of Doctor Who. Earlier last month, we found out that episodes 1 and 3 of the Dalek Master Plan, a 12-episode serial with about 5 good episodes, have been rediscovered, given a nice cleanup, and were posted both on the BBC iPlayer and on the classic Doctor Who YouTube channel. And so, of course, I have watched them, and it's always a magical feeling for me when they find previously lost episodes of classic Who. Partially because, like, as time goes on, the chances that there are any remaining gets slimmer and slimmer. So the fact that we found two full episodes in a collection this late in the, you know, this far out, does give hope. And also, it's just nice to just watch. Like, I never realized how much I really enjoyed the Hartnell era when I've been doing my slow burn rewatch of Doctor Who. And it was nice to go back and watch brand new episodes of William Hartnell.
Excellent. Yeah, I saw these originally. A lot of the Hartnell ones where they were just like press images and audio, I would watch as Christopher Nolan intended, on a tiny netbook screen on a train while commuting with some earbuds in. So the idea of going back and actually getting to see some of them is definitely appealing. You said there are a couple of good episodes in this. Are episodes 1 and 3 any of the good ones?
Yes, actually.
Oh, excellent.
Although it would have been funny if the episode we had found had been episode 7, The Feast of Stephen, where the Doctor, Stephen, and Sarah Kingdom end up in at a 1930s-style British police station, and then in like silent era Hollywood, and get caught in Christmas-based shenanigans,
oh God.
Which leads to the recurring joke where I think the Doctor meets a very young or a silent film actor, and the silent film actor keeps complaining that all the good stunts have all been done by Chaplin.
Huh?
And the Doctor wishes the audience at home a Merry Christmas. One of the, the few times where Doctor Who breaks the fourth wall.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully there'll be a copy of that one day. But yeah, it's good to hear that it's, you know, they're still finding some.
And you know what? After the kind of disappointment with the whole RTD2 era of Doctor Who, it is nice to kind of feel good about Doctor Who, you know, something new happening with Doctor Who.
Yeah, even if it's a kind of recovery of some old bits.
Yes.
But yeah, it's still good.
Cool. So, Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing, non-Space 1990 thing have you been enjoying?
I've been enjoying a novel called The Employees by Olga Raven. Yes, I saw that look. I can read.
I mean, can you read something which doesn't have Cyclops punching someone?
Look, just because it doesn't have pictures in it, it's still... prose is still a valid form of reading, even if it isn't sequential. It's fine. It's fine. And actually, certain chunks of this novel weren't sequential even. It's a science fiction novel set on a spaceship where the employees, there are like artificial humanoids and humans, and some items have been acquired, and people are beginning to kind of get fixated and start changing. And while the humanoids are supposed to just be artificial people, there is a kind of a yearning and a kind of existential desire happening with them. And it's a fascinating read. It's very short. Each page is, well, each chapter is an entry from someone. It doesn't name each person who's doing it. It just numbers them, so you know sometimes when some are slightly out of order. And apparently this was a companion piece to an exhibition of strange objects that an artist had made, but I'd only found out about that after reading the novel. And I mean, I like a bit of space horror, I like a bit of space weirdness, and after running Cosmic Dark and Mothership and things like that, I saw this cover that had what looked like kind of mannequin limb kind of pieces all around and The Employees on it. And I was like, yeah, let's try that out. And it's not entirely that. And similarly, I want to throw it at Matt Hardy, friend for show, because his miniseries for Mad Cave, Cyberarchy, has a lot to do with robots and emotions and civilization and things like that. And again, while it's not this, it's not this. So it'd be interesting to see if there's anything that he would particularly appreciate or take from it.
I am looking it up now, and that does seem really interesting.
Yeah, definitely recommend that. I also, trying to accelerate beyond finishing at most one novel a month, I finally got round to finishing House on the Borderland, which also very good. I'm shocked that I hadn't read it much earlier.
Well, the House, hang on, I've read the House. Is that's by
William Hope Hodgson?
Yeah, I read that. I think I read that about last year. Mm. And yeah, that's a mindfuck.
It is. It's good fun. Yes, but we're not here for to get ourselves mindfucked. No. We are here to watch the madness happening for people of Moonbase Alpha in Space 1999. There are probably better ways I could have worded that, but I don't care. So, first up, we have Space 1999 Season 1, Episode 2, titled Force of Life. Now, I know there are different episode orders. I'm just going with what IMDb threw me. So, this aired on the 11th of September, 1975. God, Miles, do you think they knew it was September 11th back then?
Probably not.
Okay. The script was by Johnny Byrne, who, as far as I'm aware, bears no relation to the Canadian artist and General Git, and directed by David Tomlin, who worked on The Prisoner. I see on the notes here, which is cool. Yeah, this isn't a prisoner recap thing, because it can stand on its own. It's very good. You should all see it. Anyway, the UK number one hit when this aired was Sailing by Rod Stewart, and the US number one hit was Rhinestone Cowboy by Glen Campbell. Sailing, I saw the music video, and I swear my mum looked exactly like this in the 80s. Like, had the same haircut, a whole deal. But yeah, not the weird jaunty sailor's hat.
Okay, I also watched the music video based on your recommendation, and I was very I was very surprised that Rod Stewart is essentially dressed as a member of the village people.
Yeah, yeah, it was an experience. I don't think I've ever heard it properly. Most of the time, it's the kind of song that you would hear on a bus or train from a bunch of drunk people. I'm not sure why, but it's definitely got that kind of tone to it.
And then we have Rhinestone Cowboy,
mm.
which I'm only convinced exists because I think Glen Campbell wanted to prove he could ride a horse.
Okay.
Because he seems very proud of the fact that he's on a horse when we see him in the music video. But my God, both of these videos were incredibly washed out to kind of simulate that 70s vibe of everything is beige and horrendous. But, you know, it was fun to see Glen Campbell walking down a city street in his rhinestone shirt, looking like he should be in a weekly US drama about a drifter called The Rhinestone Cowboy.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. With a name like that, I can't imagine the show would do brilliantly. But, you know, maybe. Maybe.
I think it'd be one of those ones which somehow is a complete flop in the US, but is popular enough in the UK to get like a crappy annual, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe a little bit of hipster cred in the US when it gets, you know, when some people could pirate it or something. But yes, so, yeah, what on earth is Force of Life about? Mars, you have 5 minutes, or Lovejoy is going to come and get you. I'm sorry, I don't make these rules.
He's Lovejoy.
Exactly. He is unstoppable. So, you have 5 minutes, starting now.
Ooh, we're in space, and there's a glowing, twinkly blue light heading towards Moon Base Alpha, the Earth's moon, which has been, because of a nuclear explosion, sent off into deep space for weirdness. Meanwhile, everyone's kind of, doing their thing, including Anton Zoreff, who I'm surprised to find out didn't turn out to be a sexy bad boy, but instead, like, a sexy, brooding young man who's really good at his job, maintaining the one of Moonbase's Alpha's many nuclear power plants. He makes his way to his shift, and then the blue energy enters the power plant. Everyone around Moonbase Alpha starts to go into slow motion walking and then stops, except for Anton Zoreff, who gets hit by the strange glowing blue light. He recovers in sick bay, and he is told by Dr. Russell that he needs to kind of take a few days off. You know, he's got to get some of his PTO sick leave hours in. But Anton really, really wants to get back to working the reactor, but hey, doctor's orders. I got some PTO. He goes back to his quarters where his girlfriend lives, and he starts messing with the thermostat to make everything really, really hot because he's really cold. Nothing suspicious going on there. He leaves and he goes to the nuclear power station, and he finds one of his co-workers there who he touches and immediately freezes to death, draining him of body heat. He panics and he runs away. Unfortunately, Anton is driven by the need to hunt down and drain more people's body heat. And he does this like once or twice before the crew realize, oh shit, something's up with Anton. And they manage to capture him. It turns out that the strange force that infect that that connected with him has turned him into some kind of strange heat-absorbing vampire. Not like one of your normal vampires, but a space heat vampire. He escapes, and he makes his way to Moonbase Alpha's solarium, which is basically a giant tanning salon, which seems really silly at first, and I thought, oh wait, they live in a basically huge underground complex. These guys are going to be needing some vitamin D, and also we need an excuse to have just show some women in bikinis. They catch him, and he escapes again, and he makes his way to the power plant. Koenig has the brilliant idea of turning off all the power in Moonbase Alpha to kind of draw Anton to where they can trap him. Unfortunately, this also includes the life support system and all the stuff they need in sick bay to keep the sick crew alive. 10 out of 10 for out of the box thinking, Koenig. 0 out of 10 for we're gonna get a body count on this one. They track him down. Anton gets shot, and he immediately turns into a crispified, mud-covered version of himself with glowing white eyes. He makes his way into the power plant. Koenig is forced to turn the power back on, and Anton draws from the power of the power plant, causing a tremendous nuclear explosion on the moon, killing Anton immediately. But thankfully, they have other nuclear power plants on Moonbase Alpha, so they're good for power loss. And also, it didn't start a second nuclear explosion, which might send Moonbase Alpha heading straight back to Earth, because that's how physics work.
Wow.
The end.
That's with 39 seconds to spare. I think the first time in a little while that one of us has come under.
No, I did. I came under on Final Frontier.
Oh, wow. God, what's that say about Final Frontier?
This one has a guest star, a very young Ian McShane.
Oh my god.
People of our generation know him as dodgy art dealer with a heart of gold Lovejoy, or if you watch Deadwood as the incredibly foul-mouthed Al Swearington.
Swearington.
And also given Charlie's reference to John Wick as one of the background characters with a huge backstory in the John Wick universe of films.
God, he's more than background. Winston is, increasingly prominent through the series and a lovable scumbag, really, which actually, yeah, scumbag in varied forms is where Ian McShane's forte seems to lie. As someone that never actually saw Lovejoy, seeing him in Deadwood, he is gloriously obscene in that. He is, before Game of Thrones had the term sex position coined for giving exposition while having sex. Before that, Al Swearengen was telling prostitutes about his tragic backstory while they were sucking him off. So, yeah, he managed to get beaten and battered a lot in Deadwood while remaining one of the most intimidating people in an already scary town. So seeing him turning a bit villain here, yeah.
I was honestly kind of surprised because, again, I know this guy from where his career is going, and especially given his 70s hair, I thought like he was going to be like a scumbag who gets his.
Yeah,
but it's just like, no, he seems to be like a nice guy. Like he's very dedicated to his job. And, you know, when he starts turning into a heat vampire, he's really distraught about it. But unfortunately, proceeds to do the one thing that one guy always does in a zombie movie is gets bitten and doesn't think to tell anyone that he got bitten by a zombie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I assume you've had this as well, of people in the workplace suffering from like colds or flu or anything and coming in that kind of work martyr sort of way. And it's like, guy, if you're ill, be ill.
I had a coworker come in with COVID.
Motherfucker.
While my wife was immunocompromised because of chemotherapy.
That is some real shit behavior.
Like, and it's not as if that, and they knew that my wife was immunocompromised because of chemotherapy. And it's just like, wow, you're a, and you want to go into nursing.
God. Madness. But yes, this episode was very good fun. It turns out there's a, you'll see a pattern emerging with some of these episodes that we're covering tonight, as the glowing blue cosmic entity swings by and Lovejoy goes all kind of heat vampire. Is it's not the only time a cosmic entity assaults this place. They seem to be like a bug light for it.
Space is big, but they draw every single weird cosmic Lovecraftian horror and cultural eugenicist in the area.
I guess at least he's not doing a eugenics program. He's just accidentally, and then kind of, you know, it feels like there's a slight turn in that, especially when he's kind of being a bit weird and stalkery in the solarium.
I know we joke about that we go to space 1999 when we get too British for Star Trek's usual brand of like optimism. But the thing I really find myself enjoying whenever we go to space 1999 is to watch something with actual production values put into it. Because, like, you know, it's night and day because, you know, Star Trek in, like, its classic formats isn't the most big budget of shows.
No, God. Even, like, in the more modern eras, you see so many ways that they try to cut corners.
And one of the things I feel that Space 1999 always gives us is, like, actual, honest-to-God attempts at cinematic filmmaking. Because there is some fantastic use of light, especially since the Anton vampire draws light and power from the areas around him. So there's a couple of scenes where he's stalking the corridors of Moonbase Alpha, which are usually pristine and sterile white, and all the lights are going off. And some nice use of a fisheye lens.
Yes. I did put on my notes, there's some real Garth Marenghi-ish slow-mo here. Like when everyone freezes but him, people stop at slightly different times as well, which, like, oh, bless. They couldn't just freeze that image because no one was going to be moving. No. They had to actually go and
stop.
Stay still now. There were, like, when he got all crispy, it made me want to rewatch Sunshine again with the old, Mark Strong burnt crispy body.
I recently went to see Project Hail Mary, and I really wanted to rewatch both Sunshine and Interstellar.
Okay.
But, like, Sunshine, I got to see Sunshine in the cinema, and it looked really good then. I'm glad that the film has kind of gained a bit more of like a rediscovery as time has gone on. Because I feel like the film was just kind of very underappreciated when it originally came out.
Definitely. Also, one of my other notes I have here is this going to be some Gary Mitchell bullshit? Which, again, we will see plots in here that Star Trek either has or will use. As, he kind of gets weird powers. Not quite godlike, though. This is, again, this is the British show equivalent of it. He gets powers and it fucks his day and everyone else's day. Like, no one's having a good time.
But you know, this is Space 1999. Koenig isn't going to beat anyone to death with a rock, because even though they all live on a giant rock, it's going to be a clipboard. He's going to bludgeon someone to death with a coffee pot.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, so with all that, we have something I completely forgot until literally this morning. We have the space slate where we write down where in best to worst these episodes fit on our list of, I guess, eventually 48 episodes of Space 1999. So at the moment we have in episode 1 Death Star for Dominion with a fucking skeletonized Brian Blessed. Oh my god. And in number 8 we have Breakaway, which is still really good. Like, we've not yet hit the point where the bottom of the list is a bad one. So yeah, where should Force of Life go?
Oh man, like, you know, in our 8 so far, I think we have definitely top loaded here. Yeah. Because, like, okay, like at number 3 we have Dragon's Domain, which has a tentacle monster killing Mr. Bronson.
That was so good.
Yep. And then number 6, okay, number 5, End of Eternity, where a very tall guy in all black with some very scary art goes on yet another kill spree of Moonbase Alpha.
Oh damn.
Oh my god, like, I mean, okay, how much do you remember of End of Eternity?
End of Eternity. Oh dear. That's difficult. When you were saying about the weird guy, I was like, hang on, was that not Black Sun?
No,
definitely some similarity with some of the themes and ideas from these episodes.
Sun is the one where they go through the black hole.
Oh yes.
And then time just goes wibbly, and there's that implication that God, the universe, is kind of helping.
Yeah. It was Dragon's Domain that had the spaceship graveyard.
Which, yeah,
I loved that spaceship graveyard. That was a really nice touch. And again, like, I think around that time I was running Mothership. And it's like, yes, feed me these bits of space horror.
And then, like, at number 6, we have Mission of the Darians, which is the giant colony ship with a breeding program.
Of course, as you do.
And, you know, people shouting, MUTANT! Like, oh my god. I think that I might have to say that this is our new number 6, because while this doesn't have that core, just MUTANT!
Well, yeah, which you have said at me multiple times since we saw that episode.
Look, you're an X-Men fan, so should be used to it.
Yeah, fair. I think, while my memories of the Weird Hell, is he the guy that was like Darth Vader coded?
He's the conceptual artist who instigated a breeding program.
Yes!
Which involved a lot of murder, because they always do.
Koenig
has to kill him by sucking him out of an airlock, and he's having to fiddle with the fire safety sheet next to the airlock to trick him. Because he gets the guy, and the guy batters Koenig in the head with a plane, and it's really visceral.
God, yeah, that was great. That looked painful. Yeah, I'm good with End of Eternity above this. Yeah, brilliant.
MUTANT! Nice.
Yes. Well, and on that note, on that bombshell, let's continue. So, episode 2 of the evening is Space 1999, Season 1, Episode 7, titled Alpha Child. This aired on the 16th of October, 1975. Script originally by Edward DiLorenzo, but apparently very heavily rewritten by Christopher Penfold. Directed by Ray Austin. The UK number one hit was Hold Me Close by David Essex. And US was Bad Blood by Neil Sedaka. Yeah, alright, Hold Me Close was fine. Like, I gathered David Essex was a big deal. Felt a little low effort, but sure. Yeah, and Bad Blood, I was putting these on last night while Emma was about, and when I started typing Bad Blood, she was like, that wasn't the 1970s. So, I don't know, there's a different one.
Yeah, I like the songs were fine. Like, you know, it's the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. They feel like the kind of things that an older filmmaker would put in as current, what was current to them, but would be seen as possibly charmingly retro to everyone else, which, yeah, fine. Anyway, I need to just prepare for a glowing green thing this time.
You have 5 minutes to recap the episode, or else you are going to die and get your body taken over by an alien entity for purposes of hiding from the space popo.
I mean, frankly, entering this body would be revenge enough on anyone trying to do that. On that note,
begin.
So, the people of Moonbase Alpha are pacing ominously until Dr. Russell calls to say, the first Moonbase Alpha baby's been born. A baby boy that's completely normal, definitely. Yes, everyone's thrilled. In space, however, there's a blinking green circle moving closer. Yes, another one of these fuckers. The baby's mother screams because her child... he's got older! Oh my god! Then the credits play and I do a little dance because it's a good theme. The mother, Sue, is in shock and has been sedated. Koenig is a bit awkward with the newborn. Not Picard, Wesley, Crusher awkward, just general awkward. Looking at the files, apparently Jack Crawford was the dad and he died a few months ago. They're still not sure why the kid's like this because he's healthy, but just... 5 years old. Also, after banging some trays together, they become aware that he's deaf and mute. Old computer boy is trying to check for files and doing nothing. And the child gets brought into main mission and everyone's weird at first. But Alan, bless him, he's actually quite nice. He asks a kid if he wants to fly and whirls him around main mission. And that seems to have broken the ice. Eleanor mentions that they're have decided to call the boy Jackie, and Jackie's surprised by the existence of sliding doors and then smiles when Koenig smiles at him. Koenig shows Jackie some screensavers and the boy is really into them. Then he looks like he's going to push some serious buttons on the display, but he doesn't. Koenig, however, he's clocked this. Victor tries to teach Jackie to draw a flower, but is transfixed by Victor's science orb in his room. Jackie gets a tour of his dad's old bit of the base and then gets a little trip on an eagle with Alan. His mum, however, she's still unresponsive. For some reason, in my notes, I thought she might be dead at this point, but put a pin in that. That green circle, it's back and it's become a spaceship. Oddly enough, Jack is drawing a picture of it and then crumples the picture as this ship arrives. Everyone's suspicious of the ship, and Alan's really eager to shoot it with the guns. But Koenig tells him, no, just fly about a bit, get in its face, see what happens. And as they didn't shoot him, maybe it's not hostile. Not everyone has to be bastards in space, right? I mean, wrong, as it turns out, wrong, but you know. But there is that thing of they might be like Jackie and simply unable to communicate in ways that we know. More ships appear now, and Koenig doesn't want to attack, but he sees the kid staring and corners him, only for Jackie to crumple in slow motion and get taken to medical. Alan hops back in the Eagle and is happier now that there's an order to fire on the ships. However, no matter what, he seems to constantly miss, and then he gets downed by ominous green lights that surround his Eagle and the other ones. Jackie gets examined in medical by Bob and Helena, but Koenig's telling them to stop calling that creature Jackie. Fine. As it turns out, Koenig will be right here. But his new plan is less good. It's a bit basic. Him and three of his mates will get some of the big guns, proper bazooka-like, walk out onto the moon and start firing wildly at the soft underbellies of the green ships. Will it work? Who knows? Helena and Bob walk into into the ward, pull back Jacker's sheet, and it's an adult with a really bad haircut and a silver outfit. His name is Jarak, like someone's misspelt Garak, I assume. And he wants to know what happened while he was a small baby and child. Has anyone done anything bad to his spaceship? Not yet, apparently. So he forces Helena to call Koenig and stop him from firing. Jarak then goes to meet Sue and, oh fuck, oh no. Please tell me this isn't going to go to some, like, Avengers issue 200 places. Not quite, but still not good. He kills his Jackie's mother, and another of his kind called Rena inhabits her body. And then they kiss. Is this incest? Maybe. It's fucking weird. That's what it is. Anyway, Koenig and company sneak about with guns and are stopped by Helena, who's under control of Jarak, waving what looks like an industrial staple gun around. Everyone hands their staple guns over to stop any...
Oh!
I definitely had one of those staple guns at the comic shop.
Things I would like from this show, I would like an eagle.
Yeah.
The eagle's a pretty cool design of a ship.
They are. Yeah, they're not necessarily elegant, but yeah, I could see them being quite useful.
So, Charlie, before we continue, can you quickly explain for the folks at home what you mean by Avengers issue 200 style shenanigans?
Yeah, no fuckers owned up to being the sole responsible person for this one, but it took Christopher S. Claremont to fix it. In Avengers issue 200, Carol Danvers, Ms. Marvel, who was recently robbed of her own title, was a member of the Avengers and got knocked up by something. Like, got mystery magical pregnant, and she was freaking out, and everyone else on the team was like, oh, isn't that nice? You're knocked up. Oh, what are you going to call it? And she's like, there is a monster inside of me. What the hell is this? And Wasp, everyone was like, oh, we'll make little clothes for it, eh? And then she gives birth to a baby who rapidly ages into an adult and is like, hey, I like the look of you, so I decided to knock you up with myself. And now we're going to a dimension. And she was like, okay. And everyone cheered as she was written out of the series, only to come back when Chris Claremont, who was rightfully fucking livid about this entire thing, wrote into Avengers Annual 10, basically like Carol Danvers coming back being like, what the fuck, guys? I was mind controlled by a cosmic monster that made me give birth to it and then run away with it to another dimension. That's really inconsiderate. What the fuck? So Jesus. This, as I said, it's not that, but it's close, because he fucking kills the mother and then makes out with the mother's body while he's the aged up version of the baby. And they're both aliens who I assume are a couple who have done all this.
And When a weird sex fetish is too much for Christopher S. Claremont, who did not meet a brainwashing kink he didn't like, that says a lot.
It really does.
Thank you, Charlie. This will be our last episode. Check, please. Mwah! Good night, everybody.
Anyway, yes, back
anyway,
to this.
Anyway, back to this. Go.
So, yes, right. Staple guns handed over. Jarak and Rena, who is now inhabiting the body of Sue, are from an incorporeal species. They're the victims of a weird eugenics program this time, and they're on the run. Jarak found a newborn baby, and apparently that was a perfect host to jump into. And they've got three spaceships of incorporeal beings who need a place to hide from basically the space filth. Apparently, the hollowed out bodies of everyone in Moonbase Alpha will do. Isn't that great? No, No, none of Moonbase Alpha's people want to be corpses puppeted around by incorporeal people trying to hide from the fuzz. So, it all looks doomed, because these guys are so powerful, everyone's just dying, gasping, like dying fish, all apart from Victor, who is either dead or having a nap when all of this happened. Anyway, as this is going on, suddenly the Space Filth show up. Oh my god, they blow up the incorporeal people's ships one by one, leaving Jarek and Rena a bit like, oh, tables turned slightly, and they shoot people and run away, locking themselves in a room and being like, bygones? Yeah, after all of this, no bygones. They are not allowed to join the crew. This is really rubbish, really bad. Jack and Rena then twitch, so I assume they're taken away by the Space Filth, who then go. And yeah, Koenig gets into medical, and who's there but Sue and baby Jackie, restored to perfect health, and hopefully none of them aware that their bodies made out.
1 minute and 58 seconds.
Why does it always come
to me? All I've got to say off that is, God, I love science fiction.
Oh my days. Oh my god.
Okay, two things. One, the little kid playing Jackie, Wayne Brooks. I had to quickly go on check that he doesn't play Damien in The Omen.
Oh, he gives good evil.
He gives good evil. Second of all, the grown-up version of Jackie, Jarek, is played by Julian Glover. Now, do you recognize Julian Glover?
I didn't realize that's who that was.
Yup. He was Admiral Veers in Empire Strikes Back. He is the villain who gets aged to death. He was the one who chose Pauly in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Grandmaster Pychela in Game of Thrones. He is Scarif, Last of the Jaggeroth in Doctor Who. And I know if I mention his brief turn in an episode of Blake 7, you'll probably hurt me again.
Wow.
So okay. I won't. He has quite the sci-fi career. And also, unlike Doctor Who, where most costumes are made by duct tape, I swear Jarek's costume was made by actually slipping on actual rolls of duct tape to his person and going, okay, can we see your balls? No, good.
Good, keep going. Yes, weird silver stuff. Yeah, the haircut looked immediately like the kind of, oh no, this is what Mark Zuckerberg thought was cool before getting the broccoli hairdo. You know, the kind of, I'm a nerd who wants to have a haircut like a Roman emperor kind of style. Yeah, like, it's odd going, I think the kid Jackie was more ominous than Julian Glover as Jarek. Jarek was, you know, a bit formal, and while terrifying in the kind of, oh yes, I can just kill people, we've had that. They deal with that every week here on Space 1999. You need a better gimmick, guy.
So instead he decides to try and make out with his mother.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. But yes, as a whole, this was good fun, and Koenig was right. The child was evil. Just like the moment that baby aged up, just fuck it, out the airlock. Just, you know, save time.
We've watched the child for the show. We've watched the
we did the
weird pregnancy episode. I feel that this one, at least this one, plays up the fact that this is terrifying.
Yeah, because it would be. yeah, it's. Like, I felt annoyed that the mother had nothing in this. Like, was literally a puppeted corpse in the only point where the actress did anything. So it's all kind of, hey, the whole ship's adopting this, like, this odd child. But the child himself was nicely ominous. The fact that I went back and forth, because I've never seen Space 1999 before this. And even though I keep meaning to watch more of it, because hell, I have a Space 1999 role-playing game book and do want to inflict it on my role-playing group at some point with the pitch of, so the moon got blown up away from Earth and you're on it, which I figure will be fun out of context to people that have even less knowledge of this than me. But yeah, like, God, it's just, yeah, I was back and forth between, is the kid going to end up being all right? Is the kid going to end up being like the child from The Child and go, well, the mum's in shock, but space baby kind of thing. But no, he was evil all along and using his childishness to find out how everything works. So yeah, incredible. But,
hey, at least he got a free, Eagle Ride out of it.
He did. And yeah, like sometimes with the people that aren't, say, like Koenig, Victor and Helena, and admittedly Computer Boy, you don't see too many distinctive things in a single episode. So seeing Alan, you know, he's generally been quite nice and outgoing. So seeing him actually going, yeah, look after this kid, you know, fly the thing, it was all good. Admittedly, him being like, come on, I could just shoot this for you. So we really aren't in Starfleet now, are we?
we can't have you firing the lasers. Do you know, have you filled out the form?
Exactly. Yeah, Koenig would be very upset if the paperwork wasn't done for that.
Honestly, creepy child, creepy aliens, creepier costuming. Because apparently, Jarek aged himself up and thought, yes, this is a dignified look for me.
Yeah, the weird little necklace that had a kind of, it looked like some modification of like an evil eye kind of necklace. And then, yeah, just silver tape crossed over. And very little else. Seeing in the notes, apparently Anton Zorev from our previous episode was originally going to be the father, but it was decided, nah, let's not bother.
Continuity, what's that?
Well, given there are different orders for when these were made and produced and like put out, I guess, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it's like, it's always kind of strange to think, in this era of incredibly heavily serialized TV, much to sometimes TV's detriment, that there just used to be, like, a time when TV was produced, and it was just like, yeah, whatever, all you want to put us out, sod it. Do it. Do what you like.
Yeah, just chuck it on.
Live your truth.
So, yeah, where do you reckon Alpha Child goes on our space slate here? Because, like, the kid was entertaining. I'm not the most thrilled with this, hence, you know, any, like, the mystical space pregnancy is admittedly in 1975 wasn't as tired a trope, I'm sure, but still, yeah, coming at it, you know, God, what, 50 years later?
Yeah. Like, I feel like a lot of these episodes, there's usually some a much more weird metaphysical hook, which is like, hey, you wouldn't get this in Star Trek, or you would definitely not get it on this kind of level. Like, we have The Child, where, you know, Troy gets impregnated, and the child is actually, it's fine. It's actually, you know, everything's fine. It's all actually quite nice, apart from the horrifying implications of everything. Whereas this one, you know, we have a freaky baby, and it immediately, and almost in 30 minutes, like, yeah, we're gonna make this weirder.
Yeah.
I think this might be bottom of the list, not because it's a bad episode, but like, everything else gives us something really good, right? Really crunchy to go on.
Well, yeah, like, it's, while Breakaway is a little more basic compared to a lot of the wild nonsense that we get in this show, there's still a bit more to it. But yeah, you know, again, it's not without being fun, but yeah, I think the bottom was where I was thinking with this.
I mean, it is kind of nice to kind of see some semblance of like a normal life aboard Moonbase Alpha until the insanity comes along. But the insanity came along like literally within 30 minutes of the baby being born.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that puts it at number 10.
Man, we are knocking him down this week.
Hell yeah. Oh my god. There is something kind of energizing a bit with having the occasional break for this, because it's just nuts. Like, this one Emma was here for.
Oh god.
Yeah, she has actually seen some of it a long time ago compared to me. But yeah, yes. I mean, I'll get onto this, but there was a point where she yelled out, "Oh good, it's another breeding program." Yeah. Yeah, you got the tone of it already.
Oh my god.
Okay, so finally we have Space 1999 Season 1 Episode 20 titled Missing Link. We're finally out of 1975, as this took place on the 27th of February 1976. Script actually by Edward DiLorenzo this time, and directed once again by Ray Austin. The UK number one hit was December 63 by The Four Seasons, and the US had The Theme from SWAT by Rhythm Heritage. Yeah, I had no idea that SWAT was I knew that was a film of it years ago, but it was a TV show. This was the theme. It was very funk heavy. Yeah, it was good, and then it went on way too long.
I'll be honest, I found this theme a riot. Like,
it was all right. It
was like every single cop show and like Chop Socky martial arts movie theme tune kind of rolled into one. I had to pull up the actual theme intro for SWAT to see if someone jumps and slides over the hood of a car.
I'd hope to see that kind of thing in it.
Sadly not. You have a guy jump through a window. You have a guy abseiling a building. Well, then it freeze frames and shows like the acting. And it's like, okay, did they get to choose what they wanted their kind of intro shot in the intro to be? Like, hey, I want to jump through a window. I want to leap over a pickup truck. I want to abseil.
Nice. Yeah, when I ran the Old Ladies Solving Murders role-playing game Brindlewood Bay, I had the group introduce their characters by doing exactly that, of having them, like, living their life in Brindlewood Bay, and then a freeze, like, what moment do you freeze frame, and how do you look when you're doing it? And it's like yelling at the dog, or going, oh yes, don't you know who I am? Here's my VHS box set. Doing some gardening or light shoplifting. It was good fun.
That's amazing. But yes, the other one,
so, yeah.
December 63, I did not realize that that this is the song I've always known as Oh What a Night.
Yeah, I had no idea. I was kind of pleasantly surprised, because it's not necessarily a song I'd go out of my way to hear, but when it's on, it's like, yeah.
Right. I admit that this is one of those songs that got played every single banquet at the Hilton, so I was I've heard it, I'm good.
Yeah.
Like, it's a nice song, but I've heard it, I'm good.
Definitely. Yeah, so I started typing in rhythm, and Emma was like, that's not rhythm as a dancer, is it? It's like, no, they didn't go on that far with this. But after playing these tracks, I did have to put on rhythm as a dancer. Which, again, I've not seen the music video for. There's a lot of slow rotation with orbs. They'd have done well with, like, around Space 1999.
Hey, look, in the 70s, orbs were very futuristic, were very kind of spacey.
Well, yeah, and in the 90s, I guess they were retro future at that point.
It's like bubble. It's like the bubble lamps in the 60s. Like, how do we show that this is the future? Bubble lamp.
Yeah. Wow. So, on that note, you have 5 minutes to recap Missing Link, or a Peter Cushing of the mind will be sent into your head, and not in a good way, because I know you'd like that.
Fine.
Okay, and go.
Right, so, Alan, Koenig, Sandra, and Victor are returning from a survey mission to a strange blue planet. They tried to land, but weather conditions and gravity started pulling them down, so they had to book it out of there, and they only just got away. Then suddenly, Anna loses control of the Eagle, and it goes into a spin, and it crashes on the moon's surface. They're all knocked out, but the monitor that shows Koenig's life signs have flatlined. Is Koenig dead? Maybe, but he's also bleeding from a very severe head wound. Credits! Starring Martin Landau and Barbara Bain. Space 1999, disco music. Russell, Bob Mathias get out on the medical Eagle and fly out to do a rescue mission. Meanwhile, a space-suited figure on the moon's surface is calling to them. Wait a second, it's Koenig! What a what? They arrive. The medical Eagle arrives at the crash site. They can't risk moving any of the crew. Everyone else, Victor and Alan have recovered. Sandra and Koenig are unconscious and in a bad way. So they have to call out the cargo Eagle to fly out and pick up the Eagle bridge because they can't move anybody who's wounded. Meanwhile, Koenig is stepping on board into a darkly lit Moonbase Alpha. Wait a second, is this some kind of evil Koenig? Or some kind of Koenig of the mind? Who knows? But Koenig wanders around the dark Moonbase Alpha. Every so often, we see a strange figure in mirrors and in shadows watching Koenig. Koenig and Sandra are taken to medical, and they are put on life support to be kept alive. There is no sign that they're going to recover. Meanwhile, Koenig is approached by a strange figure called Ran of the planet Zeno, the world they were visiting. It turns out that the Zenites are a highly advanced race of people.
Sure.
Internet, we know where this is going. It's space 1999. And they're basically humans who are 2 million years more advanced than Koenig. And they think that Koenig might and humanity might be an example of the missing link in their own evolutionary history. Ran wants to basically study Koenig to find out what makes him tick. And guess what? He has illusionary hypno powers. Koenig basically tells him to go screw. And so Ran tests Koenig by making him live strange hallucinations where he's attacked by people, or he wakes up in sick bay with Victor, and Victor's like, yeah, fuck it, we should go to the planet, otherwise we're all basically a living dead out here on Moonbase Alpha. Koenig also meets Ran's daughter, who immediately wants to sleep with him, and as well she should. Meanwhile, on Moonbase Alpha, Koenig being comatose is getting everyone just really tense. Computer Boy starts screaming at someone for dropping a bit of coffee. He nearly comes to fight with Paul, because apparently no one has ever stopped to consider, hey, if Koenig is ever sick or killed, do we have, like, an assistant Moonbase Alpha manager? Or we just gotta, pick a name out of a hat? Koenig and Varna start to get along. It looks as if Koenig is falling in love with Varna, but he might just be playing her to try and get what he wants. Meanwhile, it looks like Koenig's not getting better, you guys. We should potentially have to consider the fact that we might have to switch off life support and let Koenig die, which Alan is really pissed at. Meanwhile, Victor and Paul are like, look, the reason why the crew is just so on edge is because we don't know what's going to happen to Koenig. We should elect someone to be, to take command, and so we kind of get things back to normal. We'll get better in time. And Alan's like, nope, I do not like this idea, and storms off.
Ooh, and time is up. So that's 5 minutes. Oh, Alan. Also, Isn't Paul the second in command?
I don't know. You'd think so. I assume so.
Like, Paul, say something, mate. They're like, oh, if only we had some kind of backup person in charge. It's like, he's right there. I'm pretty sure he's right there. But yeah, anyway, carry on.
Varna starts to think, maybe capturing people and then testing them against their will is morally wrong. And Ron's like, I see nothing wrong with this. Until he finds out that Koenig wants to sleep with his daughter. And Ron immediately goes, I see everything wrong with this. I'm going to convince you to stay. They're about to switch off your life support. Here, I'll bring Sandra into our dream mustard realm to tell you what they're going to do. Koenig's like, well, I'm convinced. I want to go back to Moonbase Alpha. Varna's like, don't forget me, and fades away. Ron is just kind of like, you know what? You Moonbase Alpha people are too emotional. We are too rational and intellectual. Maybe one day you will evolve, we can evolve together to find like a good middle ground of the two, and I hope you don't forget us. Meanwhile, Dr. Russell is going to switch off Koenig's life support system. Alan storms in and then just starts punching people immediately. He was just like, you can't kill Koenig! I'm gonna just get myself thrown in jail. Alan is forced down and pinned down by security, and Dr. Russell turns off Koenig's life support. Meanwhile, Ron and Koenig are having a nice comfy chat in the mustard dream realm. Ron's like, hey, see ya, peace out, and like retreats into the mustard mists of the dream realm. Koenig wakes up, despite the fact that he was dead for a while, and everyone's okay. Although Alan is going to get some weird looks because he did kind of punch a good chunk of the staff at Moonbase Alpha.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 2 minutes and 2 seconds over. And yeah, the people going, oh no, I'm plugging, must have felt a bit awkward at the end of all of this. Go, well, I mean, he did survive, which, fine, but we did nearly murder him. Well, we did nearly kill him. But, yeah, like, it's, we've seen people go into weird mind space kind of things. But there's rarely a Peter Cushing there, especially one so ominous.
I mean, it's always great to see Peter Cushing in anything. I feel like he gets a much more dignified makeover job than Christopher Lee did in his episode. Because at least with Peter Cushing, like, we're just going to give you gold face paint and a big wig.
Yeah, we might actually just like a sun lotion bit.
Yeah. I mean, actually, we might just give you Christopher Lee's wig from his episode. How's that sound?
It looks like it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, and how are you going to dress me? It's like, we're going to dress you like Naboo from the Mighty Boosh. And we're just going to wheel you around on a little trolley.
We're going to dress you as some kind of problematic sultan, but you're in gold face. That's fine, right? I think that's fine. It's like, right. And then your daughter is going to be wearing some like Star Wars Episode One shit and like a lot of sequins. And yeah, just like, hey, Koenig, come join me in this psychosexual mindscape. With her dad kind of watching at times, like when she was like, oh, come on, Koenig, like you, me, this telepathic plane or whatever it is that we're in, and just the camera going back and back to seeing Peter Cushing watching them. It's like, you'd better not be getting off on this, you weird freak. But yeah,
I'm only getting off on this logically.
Exactly. Yes, space rationalists. The worst kind of space people.
I do have to say, I get the point of what they're trying to make with, you know, logic versus emotionalness. This feels like the wrong show to be going, oh man, you humans are too emotional, because this is a very, like, have you seen the show? These guys are like the most logically driven space crew ever.
But their main emotion is willpower. You know, the Green Lanterns showed us that willpower is an emotion. So, you know.
Like, the most emotion these guys show is Koenig going, are you guys into eugenics? Yes. All right, let's go.
Right, on to the next one. Or Alan, you know, can I fire the guns now?
Man, Alan was on one today.
Oh, wow. Apparently, Matthias's actor, Anton Phillips, decided to do his own stunt at the last minute and got knocked out by Nick Tate. I was like, oh, God. That's brilliant and awful. And just like, yeah, leave it in, I guess. Sure.
you know what? That's amazing. I love it when this is, guys, this is why we have a stunt crew.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the first times I was aware of these kind of mishaps was Daredevil, where Jennifer Garner kicked part of Ben Affleck's nose off in a scene. So they had to have putty covering up like a bit of it, covering up the wound, and it burnt for the whole thing. I was like, yeah, that's rough. Like, I get she does her own stunts because she's been doing that for years in Alias, but Ben, man, maybe leave it to someone else.
Yeah, it's quite funny just how many of the more modern Doctor Who's have ended up with really bad back problems, just from all like the kind of stunt and wire work.
Of course. Yeah, with this, it was interesting seeing it all and watching it with Emma, who hasn't seen many of them, but unlike previous times where I've used ITVX, the extreme ITV, to watch it on a tablet and then have adverts, we were preparing for some building work. So I had this on while we were arranging bits and pieces in the lounge on my newly acquired DVD copies of Space 1999, which is in a completely different order than what we've been using number-wise. But it's too late now. So, it was interesting watching it with her and her kind of early on watching the desperate bid for survival, the crash, the wounded. She was like, this would have made a really good season of The Terror, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I could see that, you know? Yeah. And even though she'd not seen any of this for years, she recalled enough to go, oh God, it's another breeding program. When Peter Cushing was explaining his plan, it's like, yeah, they do that out here in space.
It's either that or you just screaming, it's another fucking breeding program, isn't it? From, you know, all the times it has appeared on this show while we've been watching.
Yeah. Just like, oh, good, eugenics again. Right. Oh, God. I mean, that said, at least when Peter Cushing was delivering some ludicrous lines, like from the off, he delivers some stupid lines very, very well. Like, he is so good in all of his delivery. And this is why they get Shakespearean actors doing, like, your mid-era Star Treks, because they're good. They're good at delivering this kind of shit.
This is why I think the main reason why Doctor Who is so well-remembered, it's getting really good actors to deliver some cringe dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah, 'cause, I mean, it's kind of fun when they do that. But yes, the weird psychic mindscape was entertaining, although Victor, like, Peter Cushing being Victor in one of those moments was like, man, you're laying it on a bit thick. You didn't have to be so obviously not Victor and go, well, it's shit, we're all dead anyway. It's like, man.
Dude, calm down.
Like, ease him into thinking this is real, because this isn't doing it.
I again on the fantastic filmmaking work, just the scenes of Koenig wandering around the darkened halls of Moonbase Alpha, where you have little jump scare moments of Peter Cushing in a mirror or the background just like, I'm watching you.
It's so good. Although, admittedly, Emma and I were discussing, like, was this that Martin Landau was the one that drew the short straw and had to remain here while everyone else had a day off as he was wandering the empty halls? It's like, yeah, we've all gone out, you know, all gone down the pub.
We've gone to the pub down in Shepperton.
Exactly, yeah, you know, keep Peter busy for us.
Keep him busy, he tends to wander.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And the last thing we want is a gold-faced Peter Cushing scurrying around Buckinghamshire.
I mean, that would be kind of great. But yeah, this, I feel there are some points where maybe it went on a bit longer than it needed to with the psychic mindscape side of it, but it was still very good fun.
Man, I love the two kind of, the collection of weird mind monsters that Koenig gets attacked with. Like, one which is just a guy with an exposed brain and no eyes.
Oh, that was some Hellraiser shit. That was great. It was like, what? Monsters? What the hell? Yes! I did put on here, like, is this like the clown Matrix horror thing from Voyager? Like, yeah. Brilliant. Oh, and Computer Boy had a single scene where he wasn't talking about computer. It's like, oh, it's like the Bechdel test, but for him and computer. Like,
but also, he had like a spinny chair. He had like a spinny desk thing.
Very nice.
Oh, God, so yes. Like, man, we're going to go back to Star Trek, and it's just going to look really cheap by comparison.
I mean, certainly the original stuff, definitely. But yeah. I mean, even things like Enterprise, which I love the props existing in the Enterprise set and how physical it feels. But yeah, like, where's all their weird white kind of sterility and all of the props, and yet at the same time the lived-in-ness of going, yeah, we've got some mugs and shit, like, we've got stuff.
Things you wouldn't get in Star Trek: Riker shouting at someone because they dropped the coffee.
Yeah, I mean, he'd probably get upset with them, but he'd try to control it a bit. But yeah, like, people moan about the lack of pockets in most of Star Trek. I have difficulty not having a coffee at all times at work, like, just to hand. If there was an action figure of me, it would be holding a mug of coffee. That's a given. That I've known since I was like 20 and the addiction started. But yeah, like, where are the people going? Yes, I've got my TL Grey Hot. I've got a little coaster next to the captain's chair. You know, a little caddy.
You know, someone has to they have to have a catering department. And I feel sorry for the guys who are like, yeah, we're on the moon. We've been blasted out into deep space. We're getting attacked by the weirdest shit the cosmos can throw at us. But if Koenig doesn't have his jammy dodgers, fuck, I'm in trouble.
Oh my God.
I'm getting written up.
That's when he'll lose his shit. You know, that like, Koenig composure will crack. If he does, if there's only rich tea left.
If Koenig runs out of his Garibaldis, we're doomed.
Yeah, also you do have to call them squashed flies to him. It's tradition now.
I think that's just like, despite the fact that this show has like big American actors and actresses leading it, it just feels so British because it is just people coming in and going, coffee, coffee.
I mean, yeah, like, that's, I think, one of the things that won me over on an initial skim of the Space 1999 role-playing game that Modiphius put out is one of the traits that people can get basically gives everyone a bonus when you get the drinks in. It's like, yes, yes, this is what I want from a
role-playing game. This is the future.
Yeah, damn straight.
It's like, you know, okay, Star Trek and Stargate, you can kind of keep your, like, optimistic, idealized visions of the future and, like, paramilitary intervention in deep space. British science fiction will have weirdness and coffee runs.
Damn straight. God, yeah, I was making specifically like British slightly cozy murder mystery characters as pre-generated ones for a like rural England Call of Cthulhu game the other week, and as well as the usual bits like, oh yes, you know, here's your selection of options for kind of your hair, how you look, how you dress. Also, what order do you get in at the pub, and what's your hot beverage of choice? Because, man, these are important.
Are you a milk first, then tea, or are you tea, then milk?
Exact. One of these is wrong, by the way. I'll just say that. One of them, I'm penalizing your next role.
Do you like rich tea, or do you like a chocolate biscuit? Do you like a hobnob?
A hobnob is quite nice. I'm partial to a hobnob.
I was able to get myself, I was able to get a packet of rich tea, which I've not had in the longest time. And it's kind of nice to have a rich tea, because, you know, sometimes you do want, like, no frills, no whistles, just a biscuit.
Look, as plain as they are, the moment I started drinking coffee and then dunk a biscuit in the coffee, revolutionary. Amazing. And then it's like, I see your purpose now, Rich T.
I admit, I have to have dark chocolate digestives because of my diet.
Of course.
But like, oh man, I do miss a hobnob.
So I feel as we're on biscuit chat, we may be
biscuit hashtag biscuit boys.
Oh no. Yeah, we may be at the limit of our conversation on the missing link. So on that note, where should Peter Cushing, like, first of all, is Peter Cushing's appearance better than Christopher Lee's? And I say this knowing Christopher Lee's rider for appearing in this was that Peter Cushing get a job doing something at some point.
And that's friendship. That's friendship.
That is real friendship there. I love that.
It's like you hear about how grumpy Christopher Lee just kind of comes off. Except whenever it's in context with Christopher Lee, with Peter Cushing. Because apparently once they went to the cinema to watch old cartoons, and they got kicked out for loudly doing the voices themselves. And it's like, oh God. Aww. You guys, I just want to hang out. I just would love to have hung out with you guys in the pub.
See, that's like the wholesome version of when Adam West and Frank Gorshin were thrown out of an orgy for refusing to break character as Batman and the Riddler.
Okay, I think appearance-wise, Peter Cushing comes off a lot better than Christopher Lee, who in his episode does look like backup dancer for Spinal Tap.
Yeah,
but I think I do prefer Earthbound, because it does have that ending where that one bastard gets his.
I think it just pips it for me, because yeah, as you say, Peter Cushing looks better. They both look ludicrous, and they both give us some of the best deliveries aside from Brian Blessed up at the top here, who is just a legend. But yeah, I think Earthbound might be slightly better. I do notice, looking at this list, we do have a conspicuous absence of any season 2 episodes. Now, I'm slightly worried to ask, Miles, why have we not covered any of season 2?
Partially because season, you know all the stuff we kind of like the very dark tone. And
yeah, yeah, like what if Garth Marenghi was actually serious?
Yeah. Season 2 is a bit more Star Trek, and in fact it shares one of the producers from season 3 of Star Trek, the one that gave us Spock's brain, and I've just kind of not wanted to get to season 2 because, you know, I heard it's a bit of a tone shift.
Okay, that's right. We're 11 episodes
but, you know, out of 48. I think for Space Camps 4, I am down with finally tearing off the plaster and, God, I almost said Band-Aid. I've lived in this country for too long. tearing off the plaster and finally doing some season 2 of Space 1999.
Excellent. Cool. Yeah. Well, next time, however, we will be back to Star Trek. Yes, we have another very, very basic theme that anyone can get behind. It is amnesia-based workplace malpractice problems in the Star Trek universe. So join us to see how we've managed to wring out three episodes of that exact thing. Miles, before I bash you on the head and send you to work in the mines, where can people find you?
They can find me on my Blue Sky at milesreedlibato.bsky.social, and they can find me on my blog at mareedlibato.wordpress.com.
Nice. You can find me on skyshark.itch.io, both the website itself and as my Blue Sky account, where I'm trying to get better at posting daily about X-Men on there, because I always do that to Facebook and then forget with Blue Sky. And my own website, Faked Tales. And I'm not going to make any promises about upcoming RPG writing things, because I don't want to tempt fate. And I've no idea when they're coming out. But one day in 2026, RPG things I have written. Ooh.
Ooh.
Go to Fake Tales. You'll see an announcement when it's done. And of course, you can find us on Casual Trek, on Facebook, on Blue Sky, on Ko-fi. If you want to throw us some money and just suggest a theme, an idea, a mood even for Star Trek, for Space 1999. Yeah. Or if you throw us a lot of money, I might actually read The Second Tech War. But until then, go do a moon base.
Go get coffee for everyone.
And some biscuits as well.
Go have a coffee and disrupt the eugenic breeding program.
Oh, God, please. Yeah.
Space Scamps is a Nerd and Tie production hosted by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato, who both have edited it. Space 1999 is owned by ITV Studios Global Entertainment. Not us. Not likely.